When Kim Jong-il died in 2011, the world held its breath as North Korea entered uncharted waters. No other communist dictatorship in the last century, for that matter, no other autocratic states that are not monarchies, had been able to successfully transfer power to a third generation. Some analysts in Washington and elsewhere raised the possibility of the country collapsing in mere months. But when that didn't happen, a new theory arose. Would he be the great reformer to lead North Korea to the community of nations? 8 years on, that hasn't happened either. We still know so little about the North Korean leader, and so much of how we think of Kim Jong-un comes from media portrayals, the parodies, and assumptions amalgamated from our knowledge of other autocrats. But a new book provides the first comprehensive and readable study of the incumbent North Korean leader. Written by the veteran Washington Post correspondent Anna Fifield, the exhaustively researched new book titled The Great Successor provides a more rounded picture of the first North Korean leader to meet the U.S. president. Anna Fifield came to KAI and sat down with KAI President Ambassador Kathleen Stevens, in fact, just before the Trump-Kim summit on June 30, 2019, for a brief chat. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., this is Korean Context.
We're joined today by Anna Fifield, who is the Washington Post Beijing correspondent now and visiting us here in Washington. Anna, as I think many of our listeners know, has a long history with Korea and broader Northeast Asia. And she's come in today to talk about her great new book, The Great Successor: The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Kim Jong-un. I got an advanced copy. I've read it, and I can say, first of all, my review is this is a terrific book to read, whether it's the first book you've ever read about Korea or North Korea, or whether you are immersed in the subject and obsessed with the subject. Highly readable, extremely well-researched, and full of insights. And I want to get to a few of those today. But first of all, and I have to ask you, I mean, obviously, I've followed you over the years in your journalistic career. You've contributed so much to our understanding of what's going on in Northeast Asia and particularly in Korea. But I actually really don't know how you got involved in Korea. And could you tell us a little bit about your own background and what brought you to write this book, a very ambitious undertaking in addition to, I assume, your day job?
Well, thank you so much, Ambassador Stevens, for your kind words and welcoming me here. I'm thrilled to be here. It was just kind of fortuitous. I had no background in Asia whatsoever. But I was working at the Financial Times in London, and I'd always wanted to be a foreign correspondent. And I had been signaling this to my bosses ever since I landed in London and got this job. And one day they said to me, you know, would you like to go to Korea? And I said, yes. I had never been anywhere in Asia before. I had never eaten kimchi. I could not say annyeonghaseyo, nothing. But off I went. 6 weeks later, I was on the ground in Seoul. And it was the start of this kind of...
And what year was that?
That was 2004.
Wow.
That was a long time ago. Yeah.
About 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was just the start of this enduring fascination, I think, both with South and with North Korea. Because, I mean, as a journalist, it's such a varied beat to cover. You know, there's the Chaebol and the political scene. And, you know, it's a big economy, plus the whole North Korea side of things. So it was a very challenging and interesting job. And something about me just clicked with Korea. I really felt very happy there and like I got it and I loved being out and about and speaking to people and I just tried very hard to learn Korean and, you know, it's a fascination that has persisted to this day, 15 years later.
We're very lucky to have you continuing from Beijing now, and I want to get to DPRK China relations because as we talk today, I think Xi Jinping is just finishing up his visit to Pyongyang. But before we do all that, I do want to focus on the book because it turns out to be quite timely.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Jong-un, of course, came to power upon the death of his father at the end of 2011. That is right around the time I actually left Korea. I served as ambassador there until just that period. And of course, we were watching for a long time. This was not the first time that power had passed in the Kim dynasty, right, from father to son. And in this case, Kim Jong-un is the grandson of Kim Il-sung. I know it's a long, complicated family story. And I think the book does a terrific job of bringing kind of the human drama to it, too. And I know it's not easy to kind of figure out what's going on there. But a few things struck me, and I just wanted to get you to talk a little bit more about them. I mean, first of all, Kim Jong-un was, as we know, quite young when he came to power. But when it seemed as father, Kim Jong-il, had a stroke in 2008, and we knew that he was ill, there was a lot of skepticism. optimism that there could be another transition. Here was this young, untested guy. But if there was, one thing we knew about him is, hey, he studied in Switzerland. You know, how bad could he be? So you have some interesting reporting on his time in Switzerland, on the family dynamics. Could you just tell us a little bit about that, kind of the years leading up to his actually taking power in 2011?
I shared that same skepticism when I left Korea the first time in 2008. I could see how broken North Korea was, but also it really felt that the people had no adulation for Kim Jong-il whatsoever. One thing that really stuck in my mind was going to the Arirang Mass Games one time.
You visited North Korea a number of times.
Yeah, five times during those 4 years. You know, in the Mass Games, and they flashed Kim Il-sung's face up on those cards, and everybody erupted in this very heartfelt applause. Kim Jong-il actually walked into the stadium that day. I sat like 50 feet away from him for 2 hours. And I looked around to see the conductors, basically, because it felt like the applause was canned. Somebody had flicked a switch and told them to clap. I mean, that's a tiny little snippet, but my impression was that there was not the same spontaneous adoration for Kim Jong-il as there was for Kim Il-sung. So I also felt very skeptical that the regime would be able to pass the family dynasty on another generation. And that was like a big part of the reason I wrote the book, to try to figure out how he had done it. So to do that, I did try to set out to meet everybody who'd ever met Kim Jong-un, including during his childhood. And I was really fortunate to score an interview with his aunt and uncle, who were his guardians in Switzerland when he was there and who posed as his parents. And they also lived inside the royal compound in Pyongyang before they departed for Switzerland. And they told me they were at pains to try to present him as a normal child who loved playing Lego and Super Mario and playing basketball, of course. But everything that they described and that Kenji Fujimoto, the Japanese sushi chef, described was a child who had been groomed for this job from the earliest age. You know, on his 8th birthday, where the aunt and the sushi chef were both present, Kim Jong-un was presented with this little general's uniform and told that he was the comrade general, that he would be the leader. And his aunt said it was really impossible for him from that point on to be anything like a normal child. Real generals were bowing to him and saluting him. So he had this tremendous sense of entitlement and got used to giving orders and things. But when he did go to Switzerland at the age of 12 to join his older brother there, they tried to give him some kind of normal life. It was the first time he actually went to school. And he was said to be the son of the North Korean chauffeur at the embassy. He had friends at school, 4 friends who were all the sons of immigrants as well. He didn't have a particularly great time, though. I mean, partly because of language difficulties. He struggled to do his lessons in English and then in German. And he was kind of a bit antisocial. Some of his classmates described his strange behavior and him lashing out, kicking shins out of frustration and things. But the problem with trying to write this book is that, you know, we have so little information about him. We try to extrapolate from this to see the person he is today. You could try to psychoanalyze that a lot, I think. But what struck me is that he seemed like a spoiled brat, but not like a psychopath. None of the stories about him involve any kind of like madman tendencies or something. He was just this privileged little prince.
And that he certainly had an exposure to the world outside of North Korea, but it was a very constrained and shaped exposure.
Yeah.
Remember in the kind of the early years when people were speculating about what change he might bring, is that somehow he had been exposed to Western values, to liberal democracy, to freedom of expression, that this was going could underpin his approach to where he wanted to take North Korea. But he was a kid in a privileged boarding school, as I say, surrounded mainly, and was still living within a somewhat Korean environment.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and I came up with the exact opposite conclusion to that, that his experience in Switzerland would have showed him what life would be like if he wasn't the king of his domain. He would have just been a normal person having to do well at school and like earn their way in life like the rest of us. And so I think that this time in Switzerland and his travels around Europe probably reinforced to him the need to keep the family dynasty and the regime intact and to keep his family in this very privileged position. Because if it wasn't for this system, they would be like any other family, the rest of us.
Very interesting. You write so much, too, about the family dynamic, and that's important in a regime that does look for its legitimacy to the family bloodline. Mm-hmm. One thing I was really struck by in your book was you discovered that there doesn't seem to be any known photograph of Kim Jong-un with his grandfather, whom he seems to look to even more than his father for his legitimacy and even for his style. But why do you think that is? I mean, you and I both know from living in Korean cultural circles over the years, and this goes back, you know, many, many years, that as soon as there were cameras in Korea, Koreans were taking family pictures with each other and stylized ones. But interesting that Kim Il-sung did not have a picture with his grandson, who would turn out to be a successor.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things I learned during the reporting of this book was that Kim Jong-un blamed his uncle, Jang Song-taek, for this, because Jang Song-taek, the brother-in-law of Kim Jong-il, very powerful person in the regime, was believed to be backing Kim Jong-nam, the oldest son of that generation, for the leadership. And those two did remain close for many years, you know, right up until Jang Song-taek's death.
Kim Jong-nam had an association still with
them.
Yes,
they would still talk on the phone, and Kim Kyung-hee, his aunt, you know, Kim Jong-il's sister, they still had this relationship that persisted. And so Kim Jong-un thinks that Jang Song-taek stopped him from having this photo with or having this close relationship with his grandfather for that reason. This is such a dysfunctional family. There was so much competition between the various households, the various families that Kim Jong-il had. So there was a lot of rivalry between Kim Jong-nam and the Kim Jong-un family. And in fact, Kim Jong-nam's cousin, whose name was Ri Nam-ok, she wrote a memoir about this and describing how empty the household felt after Kim Jong-il had gone off with Kim Jong-un's mother and how kind of relegated they were. So they seemed to have experienced a decline in their status within the regime. So there was a lot of jockeying for pole position within that regime that Kim Jong-il kind of seems to have encouraged in some
way. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And this memoir, did you actually get your hands on this memoir?
I did, indeed. Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating.
Unpublished, right?
Unpublished, yeah. I mean, I hope that it will see the light of day because it contains so much fascinating information about that side of the family. I was given permission to use some of it in this book to illuminate the family dynamics in general. And I actually found Ri Nam-ok during the course of this reporting. You know, she has been outside the regime for 25 years and living under a new identity in a new country. So, you know, as a journalist, it felt like a bit of a scoop to have found her. And I met with her husband, but not with her. Her husband said her real brother was killed by this regime. Her cousin, who she considered her brother, was killed by this regime. She just can't talk about this. So as a journalist, I decided not to write about her, about where she is. You know, I know her new name and everything, but I thought out of this dysfunctional family, she is the only one who's managed to make a normal life for herself. And I did not want to be the one to blow that up.
So many fascinating threads to this, and a great tribute to your research and your journalistic and investigative skills and contact building skills. To move it up to then Kim Jong-un then taking power when his father dies, as is then expected. And now it's already, my goodness, 8 years. And it seems to me that Kim Jong-un has certainly defied many expectations. I mean, certainly those of much of the chattering class and the outside world. And I don't want to sound too Trumpian here, but actually accomplishing a lot, both in consolidating power, fairly ruthlessly, but seems in a very focused way. But I want your thoughts on this. And then, of course, in accelerating and solidifying his stated aim and his father's stated aim of achieving a certain nuclear status and power for North Korea, and then pivoting to this era of diplomacy that we may or may not be in. But I just wonder, how did he do it?
Yes, he is not the kind of cartoon character madman that he is often mocked as. He has proven himself to be very strategic and cunning. And I have to be careful when I talk about him in this way not to sound like I'm sympathetic to him, because I'm not. But he has approached this job with surprising skill. And I would say, in a way, he kind of has two Byung-jin policies. One, of course, has been the nuclear and economic dual track approach he has taken. But the first one, I think, was the way he created both loyalty and fear to consolidate his regime. And he very much set out to instill a new sense of loyalty in people and create a new cohort of people who owe their loyalty and their position to him. And that is the acceleration of this Donju master of money class that have flourished under him and are making a lot of money. And their children, the millennials of Pyeonghaetan, as it's sometimes called, because life for the elite has gotten a lot better under Kim Jong-un. And it's not just the apartment towers. You know, there are pool halls and gyms, and there's a whole kind of lifestyle of leisure and conspicuous consumption in Pyongyang that did not exist before. So for those children of the elite and those elite who are making a lot of money, life has never been better for them. They have a kind of privileged position that they would not have if they defected to South Korea. But at the same time as instilling this loyalty, he has used his predecessor's tactics of fear to instill terror into the elite. As we've seen, you know, he's had so many people purged or executed from the top, from Ri Yong-ho, the head of the army, Kim Ki-nam, the head of the propaganda unit, his own uncle, Jang Song-taek, the defense minister, all of these people, even somebody like Choi Ryong-hae, number two, who's at the top there, has been sent out for re-education.
That whole generation was gone.
Yeah, every single one of them has been sent off for re-education or worse during Kim Jong-un's time. So he certainly made it clear to the elite that nobody is safe under him, not even family members. So he's kept them in line in that way. And then there's the real Byung-jin, the nuclear economic side. And he very purposefully, I think, did these consecutively, not simultaneously, but worked on the nuclear program, made astonishing progress in terms of demonstrating missile capability, nuclear, you know, hydrogen bomb capability. And then once he had gotten to a credible level, you know, completed the program, as he said at the end of 2017, he's now pivoted to the economic line there. And I think that's where his focus is now, because he knows that he can't just hang in there like his father did for 17 years. You know, when Kim Jong-il took over at the age of 52, North Korea was in such a precarious state. Soviet Union had collapsed, Kim Il-sung had died, the famine was brewing. He couldn't do anything to make a change. But, and I think he was probably not that way inclined either, but Kim Jong-un is a much bolder, more audacious leader. And I think now he knows if he's going to stay in power for 20 or 30 or 40 more years, he needs to try to improve the economy for the masses, not just for the elite, so that he can claim, you know, as he famously said at the beginning of his reign, that North Koreans will never have to tighten their belts again.
So I take from what you say that your assessment of what created the conditions for the pivot, if you like, away from tensions leading perhaps even to conflict and war towards diplomacy, was more proactive decision by Kim Jong-un that it was time to do this, perhaps under pressure rather than sanctions, for example.
I think it was both. I think in like 2017, he had gotten a credible nuclear deterrent and was satisfied with that technical capability. But I think that maximum pressure did also have an impact. China implemented sanctions like never before. And that was because China didn't know how serious Donald Trump was. Like, China, of course, wants stability on North Korea. But the thing that they hate even more than instability is war. So with the specter of fire and fury,
a credible threat.
It was a credible threat. And the Chinese took it seriously and wanted to prove to the Trump administration that sanctions could work. So I think it's the combination of those two things that brought Kim Jong-un out to the world.
So now, as we talk today, we have first time Kim Jong-un has hosted a Chinese leader, or for that matter, any leader, correct?
Well, he's had Moon Jae-in.
Oh, Moon Jae-in, I'm sorry. Well, I don't want to get to the South Korea angle, too, but very important in the DPRK-PRC relationship, and I think it's warmed up a lot.
Yeah.
So how do you see that?
What a propaganda coup for Kim Jong-un. You know, these pictures, astounding pictures of the two of them with their heads popped out of the Mercedes cruising the streets
of
Pyongyang.
Like the sort of maze of red carpet.
I mean, this is Kim Jong-un has been to China four times. Every single time he had invited Xi Jinping to make the return visit, and Xi Jinping had not. So obviously Xi Jinping thinks the time is right, thinks that he has something to gain from this visit. It. For Kim Jong-un, the photos splashed across the Rodong Shinmun today are worth their weight in gold because it continues this process for him to be able to say, you know, I am an internationally respected statesman, you know, you should revere me, people of North Korea, because look, Xi Jinping will fly all the way from Beijing to see me here. So it's really intriguing to think what is going on behind the scenes, right? There was this astonishing op-ed that Xi Jinping had on the front page of the North Korean newspaper talking about a new chapter in their relations in very conciliatory language. I think.
And kind of saying North Korea is doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Right? That it's taking steps.
Exactly. Even though Xi Jinping, you know, clearly has not thought much of Kim Jong-un over these past 7 years, I think that he does want to encourage him down this path. He does want economic development in North Korea. He does want to give Kim Jong-un a few victories on this road so that he will continue with diplomacy, continue with focusing on the economy, and, yeah, keep those missiles in their hangars.
But it also is taking some of the pressure off of Kim Jong-un and of North Korea in terms of sanctions, because implicitly then China is probably not going to really tighten the pressure as they did before, as long as Kim doesn't test again or be too provocative.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was just in Dandong on the border and was talking to people about the sanctions. And while they were still technically in place and being imposed more stringently than I had expected, there is still a lot of activity and a lot of talk about investment in North Korea. So China is really promoting this and trying to encourage people to go and start businesses or to think about starting businesses in North Korea because, yeah, this is very much where they see the future for this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with Xi now going to the G20 in Japan and presumably seeing President Trump there, I think that the expectations are higher that Xi will have something to say about North Korea to President Trump. I would talk all evening about this book with you. I've learned so much from it. I wanted to turn back to South Korea because I think that gets a little bit lost in the discussion, frankly, in the United States sometimes. And what the impact of Kim Jong-un's outreach, if you like, as well as Moon Jae-in's outreach has been on the North-South relationship. Mm-hmm. And again, I think I'm looking more in terms of a kind of a public opinion perceptions area. You know, we've seen so much, and you've alluded to some of it in our talk. There's a lot more in the book, but there's been so much in the inter-Korean drama of the last 70 years of this divided place.
Yeah.
And I think when the rapprochement began at the time of the Pyeongchang Olympics and then Moon Jae-in's trip, as you say, well, Kim Jong-un's trip to Panmunjom, I mean, first of all, on the South Korean side, I think there was this kind of, especially for a younger generation, this kind of surprise that Kim Jong-un actually spoke Korean in a respectful way and seemed like a human being. Yes, he's a little funny looking, but, you know, he was Korean and it had kind of this big impact.
Mm.
And at the same time, you had Moon Jae-in doing things that, and certainly there had been South Korean leaders a couple of times who'd been to North Korea before, but none had ever been invited to speak to the North Korean people in a public gathering, to go to Paekdusan, you know, such a symbolic place with Kim Jong-un, all of that. All of those elements seemed at the time that maybe they were a little bit transformative, that these were kind of inflection points in how the two sides perceived each other in this battle for legitimacy or, you know, what the future of the Korean Peninsula is. But now I think there's a little bit of discouragement about that. But I just wonder how you see that.
Yeah, I mean, it was really astonishing to see the two of them on top of Paekdusan with the, holding hands and to see Moon Jae-in.
Were you there for that?
I did not get an invite, funnily enough. And to see Moon Jae-in speaking in front of 150,000 people in Pyongyang, I mean, this speaks to Moon Jae-in.
Live, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
But this is what I mean about Kim Jong-un being much bolder and more audacious risk-taking than his predecessors. I think, you know, Moon Jae-in deserves so much credit for bringing this all about. He saw that opening there, I think, and the way that they managed to invite North Korea to the Olympics. And more so than seeing Kim Jong-un as a Korean person, South Koreans saw Kim Yo-jong, his sister, who is not funny looking like he is, as this smiling, approachable, demure face of North Korea. And I think that changed a lot of perceptions at that time. But beyond that initial flurry, and, you know, I was in the press room for the Panmunjom summit, and I was actually sitting amongst the South Korean press corps when Kim Jong-un walked across the line and then invited Moon Jae-in to come back with him. And just like amongst the journalists, the shock and the happiness and the cheering, it was really very moving to see that
and these
reaction.
These are pretty hard-bitten journalists,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Cynical. But they were completely taken aback by it. But that has really faded since those first moments, obviously. And I think that's partly because it just, you know, the optic stuff at the beginning, the style is very easy, this or relatively easy. The substance is much more difficult, especially, you know, South Korea is hamstrung by sanctions. There is a real limit to what they can
do. They can do,
yeah.
They would like to do.
Yes.
The government would. Yeah.
Yeah. And so clearly they are planning to do a lot more, but they are so constrained at the moment. And that's a frustration in the relationship, I think, because Kim Jong-un expects a lot from them. He expects Moon Jae-in to be able to front up with some of the promises he's made. So that's a natural kind of break on progress at this stage. But, you know, it is encouraging that Moon Jae-in still remains very committed to this process. And, you know, that is clearly where his heart lies. I think that he is very interested in making progress on this. But so much is out of his control. He needs the U.S. to act. And he's so beholden to the U.S. in terms of, you know, it's the U.S. that signed the armistice agreement. The North Korea's beef is with the U.S. So, yeah, they need that progress to happen first.
Yeah.
Concurrently.
Yeah, well, we'll see what the next months hold. I'm glad you're still following it from your perch in Beijing.
You can check with me in 20 years. I think I'll still be following.
I've been following for a while myself. On the one hand, yeah, you know, it's funny. When we talk about Korea, I mean, in particular, I think South Korea, the story is also one of, you know, enormous change, unimaginable change, transformative events. And yet at the same time, the stubborn reality of a divided peninsula and a source of tension and great suffering remains. So, yeah, it needs continued attention and continued thinking about how we got here.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the reason why I'm so interested, because I've been to both parts of the peninsula and seen, you know, it really strikes me that it's the tragedy of it, that it's a divided country. Like, North Koreans laugh at my jokes the same way or ask me the same nosy questions that South Koreans do. It's like, it's very tangible feeling that these are one people.
Absolutely. After all these years, they are. And the status quo is not acceptable.
Yes.
So thank you for your contribution through this book, through what you're doing now. And I think we'll need you to remain engaged for some years to come.
I look forward to being Pyongyang bureau chief after unification.
Amen. Absolutely. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Ambassador Stevens.
That's it for the episode today. Many thanks to Anna Fifield and Kathleen Stevens. And to you, listeners, for tuning in. You can find Anna Fifield's new book, The Great Successor, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Kim Jong-un, published by Public Affairs, in bookstores, and wherever good tomes are sold. You should also consider following her on Twitter at ANNAFIFIELD. If you have questions or comments, please tweet at us at KOREAECONINST. And don't forget to visit KEI on Facebook, YouTube, and at KEIA.org. for videos, blog posts, and articles on all things related to Korea policy. See you next week.